The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Everyone, welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Today is the 14th anniversary of 9/11. And if you go back and think about what was happening on that day, besides the horrible tragedy, the attack from radical Islam, it really did bring both sides of the political sphere together. Democrats, Republicans alike standing together. Outside the Capitol singing God Bless America. Republicans and Democrats joined together, arm in arm. This is a government, by the way, that had been deeply divided. The year before, there was the dispute over the presidential election. Deeply divided, but that tragedy, that attack, brought the two sides together, and it brought the United States together with some of its strongest traditional allies. Before 9/11, really, President Bush and the Prime Minister of Britain, Tony Blair, really came from opposites as far as their political background goes. But if you remember, after 9/11, these two leaders really did form a strong, strong bond, a strong alliance. It was Prime Minister Blair that loaned that bronze bust of Winston Churchill to President Bush after 9/11 as a token of his encouragement, his support for the U.S. during this time of war. That attack really brought the United States and Israel together as well. So many of Israel's neighbors, of course, were cheering the day of the attack, including many in the Palestinian regions, Gaza and the West Bank. But the United States and Israel were brought together as a result of that attack. In fact, Benjamin Netanyahu gave a speech just a week and a half or so after 9/11 in Congress in the United States. And he said to them, what is at stake today is nothing less than the survival of our civilization. There may be some who would have thought a week ago that to talk in these apocalyptic terms about the battle against international terrorism was to engage in reckless exaggeration. Before 9/11, he's saying, he could see how some would say, well, you're exaggerating about the threat. Some might have said that a week and a half ago. No longer, he continued. We've received a wake-up call from hell, he said. Now the question is simple. Do we rally to defeat this evil while there is still time, or do we press a collective snooze button and go back to business as usual? So that's a good question. Asked back on September 20th, 2001, just 9 days after 9/11, 9 days after the attack on New York and Washington, D.C., do we rally to defeat this evil while there is still time? Or do we press the snooze button? He said the time for action is now. Today the terrorists have the will to destroy us, but they do not have the power. There is no doubt that we have the power to crush them. Now we must also show that we have the will to do just that. Once any part of the terror network acquires nuclear weapons, this equation will fundamentally change, and with it the course of human affairs. This is the historical imperative that now confronts all of us. We either defeat them with our superior power, he was saying, or we hit the snooze button. And time just won't go on. Once any part of that network acquires nuclear weapons, the equation fundamentally changes. The Associated Press said that after he delivered his speech, that his statements drew unusual lengthy applause from Democrats and Republicans alike. It brought the United States and Britain and Israel together. I think it was on that same day that Mr. Netanyahu gave his speech that President Bush addressed Congress and the nation. And here again, thunderous applause throughout. That was 14 years ago. In many ways, it seems like a long time ago. And look at the world today. We got the wake-up call 14 years ago today. Did we rally to defeat the evil? Did we rally to win the war? Or have we collectively hit the snooze button? That Churchill bust, that was sent back to the UK long ago. That was one of the first acts of President Barack Obama. Right after he moved into the Oval Office, let's get rid of the Churchill bust. Let's redecorate. Let's rearrange things. This administration's different. We're going to fight against terrorism using a much different strategy. Cut and run, some would say. That was several years ago that the bust was removed. Much more recent than that, yesterday, in fact. The Senate, in case you didn't notice, they rather quietly allowed for Iran to, well, this nuclear deal with Iran, to go through. An unthinkable deal that makes the world so much more dangerous. That happened yesterday on 9/10. As Mark Levin said, we not only have a 9/11, but now a 9/10, when our leaders sold us down the river. On 9/11/2001, the United States was attacked. Attacked by radical Islam. And on 9/10/2015, America's leaders sold it down the river. 14 years on, and America and its Western allies, they're handing the mullahs tens of billions of dollars, effectively sponsoring Iran's terrorist activities, even as it feverishly works to finish building the bomb. Once any part of this terror network acquires nuclear weapons, the equation fundamentally changes. Look at where we are today, 14 years on. Here we are on the 14th anniversary of 9/11, and we are seeing armies of Muslim men marching into Europe. These are young men, mostly. These are not refugees, mostly. These are young men streaming into Europe. The Dutch conservative, Geert Wilders, he's calling the wave of refugees and migrants coming into Europe an Islamic invasion. He said yesterday masses of young men in their 20s with beards singing Allahu Akbar across Europe. It's an invasion that threatens our prosperity, our security, our culture, and identity. Reuters said Wilders is, well, he said the fact that they were pushing northward through the EU from the Mediterranean indicated many were economic migrants, not refugees. I mean, they're not stopping in Greece, nor Macedonia or Serbia. All of those countries are safe. Turkey is safe. Jordan is safe. The ones that are fleeing to Lebanon and Jordan, those neighbors close by, I mean, they probably are running for their lives. But to go from Syria or Iraq or wherever on into Turkey, on into Greece, through Hungary, on the way to the more prosperous nations in the European Union. If you flee, this is what Mr. Wilders said, if you flee them, those nations, then you're doing it for benefits and a house. You're doing it for money, for benefits. Well, Mr. Wilders is in a right-wing party in the Netherlands, a popular party at that, just like many of the others in Europe that are gaining popularity because of the invasion. Melanie Phillips wrote earlier this week, accepting these migrants is a huge mistake. She said, this is not a humanitarian refugee crisis. It's a political migration crisis, an enormous and unprecedented movement of peoples from the developing to the developed world, which threatens to engulf Europe. That's right, it's threatening to engulf Europe. 14 years on, and here's where we are. Here is where we are. Did the West rally to defeat the evil? Or did it press the collective snooze button and go back to business as usual? Phillips says, but others understandably want to leave countries where they know they have no future. This is because the Arab and Muslim world is disintegrating into chaos, war, and terror. The ascendancy of radical Islam is producing untold barbarism. The West-imposed model of the nation-state is collapsing into tribal warfare. A dying culture has turned murderously upon itself while trying simultaneously to conquer the wider world. It's just disintegrating before our eyes, while at the same time, it's emerging as a regional power, a world power. I'll get to what Prime Minister Netanyahu said yesterday. He's visiting here in the UK. In any event, Ms. Phillips says, given this convulsion of an entire civilization, the line we are being fed that Britain and Europe have a moral duty to take hundreds of thousands of those who are affected is spectacularly misguided. It's just going from bad to worse, as we'll discuss further in the second segment. It goes from bad to worse because we're living in the last days. That's why. Boy, you go back and read that speech from Mr. Netanyahu, September 20th, 2001. It was a strong warning then, but it's even more sobering today when you review it. Because you see the world that we're now in. You see where we are, where we've come since that day, 14 years ago. And you know we have hit the snooze button. It's all prophesied. It's all unfolding the way Jesus Christ said that it would. This is not the same world that it was 14 years and one day ago. This is not the same world that it was 15, 20, 25 years ago. Phillips says the consequences of this migration will change Europe forever. The vast majority of this tide are Muslims. The UN estimates 70% of these people are young men. 70% of them are young men. If they settle in Europe, their families will probably follow. And then notice this. You talk about an upside-down world. She says, at the same time, Britain is keeping out Christian refugees. As Lord Carey of Clifton, the former Archbishop of Canterbury, has eloquently protested, Christians in the Middle East have been crucified, beheaded, raped, forcibly converted, and ethnically cleansed. Yet our government has so far refused requests to grant asylum to Christians trying to flee Iraq and Syria. With few exceptions, such as Poland and the Czech Republic, Europe's Christian countries are shunning Christian refugees from Islamist terror while opening their borders to hundreds of thousands of Muslims. That's an upside-down world. Here there are Christian groups being forcibly converted or ethnically cleansed, as she brings out, and the West hardly bats an eye. And now, though, now the pressure is on. Now the pressure is on to open up the doors to tens of thousands of migrants. It's not a humanitarian refugee crisis. As she says, it's a political migration crisis. Or to quote Wilders, it's an invasion. Phillips says, in Britain, there has been no outpouring of compassion over the children murdered by Islamists in Syria or Iraq. No homes have been volunteered to accommodate enslaved and mutilated Somalia girls or Somali girls. There was no support for bombing President Assad's army in Syria. There's no support for the boots-on-the-ground war necessary to stop ISIS. There's no support for taking out the Iranian regime behind Assad's slaughter. Instead, as part of the Iran nuclear deal, the UK government has agreed to make available to the Iranian regime, $150 billion in sanctions relief, which will enable it to create even more refugees, which Europe will then tell itself it is obliged to take in. And so the West continues on, snoozing, even providing funds to support terror. Terror acts that will create more refugees. Look at what's happened in these past 14 years. Look at what we were saying all throughout this period. Of course, just before 9/11, it was on May 5th of 2001 when my father announced that we had entered into the last hour before the second coming of Jesus Christ to this earth. He made that comment 4 months before 9/11. And then what a jolt. What a wake-up call 9/11 proved to be. And it was such a strong show of unity up front. Democrats, Republicans coming together. The United States and Britain, historic allies, brothers in fact, coming together to battle. Well, they called it terrorism at the start, which in itself was a sign of weakness. In any event, President Bush did identify at least three nations in the axis of evil. One of them, Iran. He said that the war against terrorism would not end until every terrorist group of global reach has been found, stopped, and defeated. Has that happened? Has that happened? Did we defeat the enemy? Have we come close to defeating the enemy? Or did we press the collective snooze button and go right back to business as usual? It was a pretty strong show of force there at the outset. Going into Afghanistan. And then we stormed into Iraq in 2003. But look at how all of that has turned out. The United States and Britain, the Western powers, taking out all of these dictators, all of these authoritarians, all of these men in strong positions of power. And look at what has filled the vacuum. And look at how terrorism now has spread. And now yesterday, 9-10, the Senate quietly moves through this Iran nuclear deal. Well, they had enough Democrats, just barely, to block any kind of official vote. And so no one gets to put their name on the dotted line because so many of them know it's going to be held against them. Because so many of them know it's going to blow up in our faces. And so it quietly moves forward. The press writes about it as if it's a great victory for the Obama administration, and it is. This is what that administration has wanted. But here you have an opposition, a majority opposition party that did nothing. It's been in the position of power in terms of numbers for the last year, and nothing. Nothing was done to stop it or even slow it down. Is the world today safer than it was on September the 10th, 2001? Is it a safer place to live or is it more dangerous? ISIS is already bragging that they've infiltrated this mass migration to the tune of 4,000 or so. That's according to the UK Daily Express. 4,000 covert ISIS gunmen blending in among the refugees, among the migrants. Maybe it's an exaggeration. Maybe it's not quite 4,000. Maybe it's 1,000. Maybe it's 100. Maybe it's 10 or 20. Who knows? The New York Daily News. This is talking about, again, this problem being something that in many ways was brought on by the West. It says Europeans still fail to internalize that a military offensive to stop Syrian dictator Bashar Assad's blood-soaked war against his civilians is the only viable remedy to stem the flow of refugees. Germany's a significant part of the refugee problem. Rewind to 2013 after Assad deployed chemical weapons to kill an estimated 1,400 civilians. The Merkel administration opposed military strikes. Assad's forces, with military support from Iran, have murdered over 250,000 people in Syria since the outbreak of a civil society movement calling for democracy in 2011. Syria's regime is responsible for 8 times more killings than the Islamic State. It's just a mess. It's disintegrating, as Prime Minister Netanyahu said yesterday. Germany was not alone in its isolation in 2013, it says. The British Parliament rejected military airstrikes. President Obama added to the crisis by walking back his commitment to launch missiles if Assad used chemical weapons. The infamous red line, in other words. Put simply, the barbaric Islamic State is largely an outgrowth of a failed Western policy to dissolve Syria's regime. Well, who knows what would have happened had that regime been dissolved 2 years ago. You look at the other nations, Egypt, Libya. Look at what's filled the vacuum. Well, from his visit yesterday, Netanyahu said he told this to the UK Prime Minister, Mr. Cameron. He said the Middle East is disintegrating under the twin forces of militant Islam, militant Sunnis, led by ISIS, and militant Shiites led by Iran. That's the cause. It's disintegrating. It's disintegrating, and yet at the same time, as Melanie Phillips brings out, it's expanding its influence around the world, exporting its mayhem, its violence, its destruction to faraway places. Is the world safer today than it was 14 years ago? What happens if one of these other triggers goes off? Victor Davis Hanson wrote about this a few days ago. All these other what-ifs. What if Putin moves into the Baltic states? What if Iran does get the nuke? And what if it does launch a strike into Israel? What if North Korea does it into South Korea? What if China, who's already on the march into the South China Sea, making islands to expand its territory? What if China absorbs Taiwan? What if we experience another 9/11? What if Europe gets hit by some of those who've infiltrated this migrant invasion? What if interest rates, just on the $20 trillion national debt, what if interest rates suddenly go up a few percentage points? Victor Davis Hanson said, at least for now, we're in a cycle of Western decline, waiting either for another Churchill, Thatcher, or Reagan to scold us out of it. Here is his hope. Or for an existential enemy, foreign or domestic, of such power and danger that all our progressive pieties will dissipate in the face of danger. Of course, he doesn't see that there's no Churchill coming this time around. No more Thatcher, no more Reagan. It's different now. It's like I was saying in that program on the proliferation of nuclear weapons. In 1945, there were just two. And they were both used to end the world's worst war ever. The next world war begins with weapons that are far more powerful than those two. And today there's 16,000 of them scattered all over the earth in 9 or 10 nations. And now Iran works feverishly to upgrade and modernize its centrifuges. Okay, so they have to get rid of some of the old ones. 14 years on, and tens of billions of dollars can return into Iran, can go right to the mullahs, so says the United States Senate on 1010 or 910. Is the world safer today? You know that it's not. You know the snooze button's been hit. It's only a matter of time. And yet, really, there is encouraging hope in all of this. Because when we see events happening that Paul talked about in 2 Timothy 3, that Jesus talks about in Matthew 24, that John wrote about in Revelation 6, there's great hope. There's great hope. Because these same prophecies, they give us the solution. I went through Isaiah 59 previously. No hope in man, that much is certain. But there is a Redeemer coming. Mark Stein, he mentioned the other day, the column that he wrote 1 year after 9/11, this would have been September the 11th, 2002. And I forget the title of that particular column, but it was something to the effect that, well, we're back to September 10th. It's like 9/11 never happened. And he's just writing a year after. Forget 14 years. A year after. And he talked about how the National Education Association, with its new attractive school books, classroom lessons, telling its teachers to teach the children about not assigning blame for 9/11, not saying, well, that group's responsible or this nation's responsible. It's just more complicated than that. Instead, talk about it in terms of it being a tragic event. It's a great tragedy. The book said, this is the education book from 2002, blaming is especially difficult in terrorist situations because someone is at fault. In this country, we still believe that all people are innocent until solid, reliable evidence from our legal authorities proves otherwise. See, we just don't know for sure. So, the National Education Association suggests this. Explore the problems inherent in assigning blame to populations or nations of people by looking at contemporary examples of ethnic conflict, discrimination, and stereotyping at home and abroad. It goes on and talks about how the internment of Japanese Americans after Pearl Harbor, and then the backlash, the so-called backlash against Arab Americans, which really didn't even happen. But it says, educate children about this, the dangers of stereotypes, the dangers of assigning blame to a specific group. Stein says, for one thing, the backlash against Arab Americans during the Gulf War is entirely mythical, but you get the gist. Don't blame anyone, but if you have to, blame America. Don't blame anyone, but if you have to assign blame, well, blame yourselves. Well, in some ways, there's some truth to that, isn't there? President Bush has won the first battle, but he's in danger of losing the war, Mr. Stein wrote. The war isn't with Al-Qaeda or Saddam or the House of Saud. They're all a bunch of losers, he says. True, insignificant loser states can cause their share of trouble when they're proxies for the great powers. But in a unipolar world, it's clear that the most powerful enemy in this war is ourselves and our determination to sleepwalk to cultural suicide in order to demonstrate our sensitivity. The great danger, as he says, is sleepwalking. Or, to put it the way Mr. Netanyahu did, hitting the snooze button. Mona Sharon, or Sharin, I guess is how you say her last name, he's paraphrasing and quoting her in his column, Mr. Stein is, summed it up in a column on the increasing pressure to pretend that September 11th, 2001 was not what it was, an act of war, but instead some sort of unfortunate tragedy. It is, she says, a kind of, quote, moral disarmament of the nation. Before there can be an army, navy, and air force capable of protecting us, there must be a citizenry that believes we are worth defending. Stein goes on and talks about an example in, I think it was brought out in a Norwegian paper, about the Muslims that were at that time migrating into Scandinavia and how there was a marked increase in rape coming from that foreign culture. And he quotes from one of the liberal papers, I think, that was saying that we need to understand the culture and that women have to do their part not to encourage rape those sorts of things. Blame the victim. Stein says at the end here, I believe Western culture, rule of law, universal suffrage, etc. is preferable to Arab culture. That's why there are millions of Muslims in Scandinavia and 4 Scandinavians in Syria. It says, follow the traffic. I support immigration, but with assimilation, he said. This is in 2002, a year on. Without it, it says, like a Hindu widow, the West is slowly climbing on the funeral pyre of its lost empires. You see it in European foreign policy already. They're scared of their mysteries, swelling, unstoppable Muslim populations. The Islamists are militarily weak, but ideologically secure. A year on, the West is just the opposite. There's more than one way to lose a war. The Islamists are militarily weak, but ideologically secure. In the West, just the opposite. That's a year on. He wrote that in 2002. And look at where we are today. 14 years from 9/11. 14 years from that dreadful day. What is at stake today is nothing less than the survival of our civilization, Mr. Netanyahu said. September 20th, 2001. There may be some who would have thought a week ago that to talk in these apocalyptic terms about the battle against international terrorism was to engage in reckless exaggeration. No longer. We've had the wake-up call. And to him, the question was simple. Do we rally to defeat this evil while there's still time, or do we press a collective snooze button and go back to business as usual? You're listening to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show on KPCG 101.3 on the FM dial in Edmond, Oklahoma. The live stream is available at kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show.
A turning point in recent history has gone almost entirely overlooked. Since that time, an unseen cause has brought about national and world troubles in unprecedented fashion. Crises are intensifying as never before. In our generation, we are seeing radical changes to culture, family, education, religion, science, finance, politics, international relations. Everything has been affected. You cannot understand events without recognizing this unseen cause. The United States has been shaken in astonishing fashion. Have you wondered why the world's number one superpower is declining so rapidly? Are you concerned about where the current administration is leading this country? The Bible provides penetrating insight into the invisible cause of society's decline. America is prophesied to fall before it rises again. The Bible also gives extraordinary insight into how that fall will come about. This insight puts the seriousness and urgency of current events in their true perspective. Understand what's in store for America and why. Visit thetrumpet.com and click on the literature tab to request this free, enlightening booklet, America Under Attack.
From the Philadelphia Church of God campus in Edstone, England, this is the Trumpet Daily Program with Stephen Flurry.
Just a few weeks after 9/11, back in 2001, we said at thetrumpet.com that Iran would not only survive America's wrath after that attack, but that it would emerge from the war stronger than ever. That's a direct quote. Stronger than ever. Iran would emerge. Now, early on, it didn't always look that way, particularly when America had such a strong presence right next door, there in Iraq, 2003, 2004, and on for the next several years. But even during all of that, we were saying, look, America's just going to hand over Iraq to Iran. And that's happened. That's happened. You can go back as far as 1994 to see where we said that Iran would eventually take over Iraq. It's happened. It's happened. Let me read to you what Ron Fraser wrote. This is in November 2001. Again, within weeks of 9/11, he said that the United States and Britain, and again, you remember President Bush, Prime Minister Blair coming together, a strong show of solidarity, friendship, an alliance, a brotherhood. And yet Mr. Fraser said that these two, America and Britain, were entering into an unwinnable war. That's a direct quote, too. Unwinnable. An unwinnable war that, as he went on to say, would sap the Brotherhood nations of their energy, their morale, their money. Mr. Fraser said, a protracted, debilitating war that will gnaw at the vitals of declining Anglo-American influence in this world, leaving them most vulnerable to the whim of the emerging three great power blocks that will seize the opportunity to divide control of the global system among themselves. These three great power blocks he was referring to: radical Islam, a united Europe, and the Asian bloc, the kings of the East. Those three. Mr. Fraser talked about how America's hour of trial would be seen as windows of opportunity for these emerging powers. And so all of this has happened, just as we've said, not because we knew anything ourselves, but because of what the Bible says. Let's just finish today by going through 2 Timothy 3. This prophecy from the Apostle Paul that we've highlighted so many times, so many powerful verses in this passage. We won't read all of them, but we have time here to get through quite a few. It says in verse 1 of 2 Timothy 3, "This know also, that in the last days perilous times shall come." Perilous times, dangerous times. See, it goes from bad to worse because of this. "Men shall be lovers of their own selves, covetous, boasters, proud, blasphemers, disobedient to parents, unthankful, unholy, without natural affection, truce breakers, false accusers, incontinent, fierce, despisers of those that are good, traitors, heady, high-minded, lovers of pleasures, more than lovers of God." Isn't that the truth? I saw an article about the Senate quietly moving the Iran nuclear deal right on through yesterday. And this particular writer's angle was, yet here we are on 9/10, as Mark Levin said, and yet look at the rundown at Yahoo News or wherever else. And of course, you have all of your familiar celebrity news, sports, entertainment, and the like. Even as Iran is feverishly working to get its nuke. Lovers of pleasures more than lovers of God. It says having a form of godliness, but denying the power thereof. From such, turn away. Turn away from it. Come out of it. Verse 7 says, ever learning and never able to come to the truth. We've talked about this in recent programs as well. not able to come to the truth. There's no truth in the land, as Hosea 4:1 says. There's no truth. I mean, doesn't this show that it's entirely possible to accumulate all kinds of new information, to gather new facts, quote-unquote, I guess you could say, but without actually acquiring truth? Is it based in reality? Is it grounded in revelation, God's knowledge? Today, the nations of this world, as Revelation 12:9 says, they are deceived. They may be ever learning, but they're not coming to the knowledge of the truth. Look at the world as it is today, 14 years on. Further down, let's go to verse 13. It says, "But evil men and seducers shall wax worse and worse, deceiving and being deceived," worse and worse. As I say, that's why you can look at the world from September 11th, 2001 to today and see why what's happening is happening. And to see how so many of these problems were, well, we brought them on ourselves. And then the solutions that are put forward, they make the matters worse. Well, there is hope, as I was saying. We won't take the time to go to other passages that speak directly of the Redeemer, of the return of Christ, like in Isaiah 59 and Matthew 24, Matthew 25. But notice what it says right here as Paul encourages his young assistant, Timothy, to continue you in the things which you have learned and have been assured, knowing of whom you have learned them. Don't forget about where you received your education. Don't let go of the truth. Don't slip into that category of so many, ever learning but never able to come to a knowledge of the truth. Remember where you receive this instruction. Verse 15 says, "And that from a child you have known the holy scriptures, which are able to make you wise unto salvation through faith, which is in Christ Jesus." See, from his early days of youth right on up, this young man had really been grounded in the holy scriptures, and they made Timothy wise. And they prepared him for his calling. They prepared him for salvation. It says in verse 16, "All scripture is given by inspiration of God, and it's profitable for doctrine, for reproof, for correction, for instruction in righteousness." Here is the real profit. Here's the real value. Here's the pearl of great price, as it says in the Gospels. This is what we need in a world that's now off the rails. We need all Scripture. We need the holy and sacred Scriptures. We need this God-breathed truth. And we need to use it for doctrine, for reproof, for correction, for instruction in righteousness. That, as it says in verse 17, that the man of God may be perfect, thoroughly furnished unto all good works. See, we've got to dig into our Bibles to strive for perfection. I charge you, the next chapter says, therefore before God and the Lord Jesus Christ, who shall judge the quick and the dead, at his appearing and his kingdom, preach the word. Preach the word. Timothy was a minister. Timothy was a preacher. Timothy needed to know the Bible. And Paul charged him before God and before Jesus Christ, who, it says there, shall judge the quick and the dead at his appearing in his kingdom. That's the solution. That's where this is leading. That's what this is all building toward. The appearance of Jesus Christ on this earth. You're listening to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show on KPCG 101.3 on the FM dial in Edmond. The live stream is kpcg.fm. It's been another fast-moving week. We appreciate you staying with us through the week, and we'll look forward to meeting up with you again next week.